This is your soundings editor, Walt Beam. You've just heard The Sound of My Heart, amplified electronically to introduce this soundings cassette on engineering in the health industry. The health industry, physicians, hospitals, and pharmaceuticals, is even today larger than the automobile industry, the defense industry, or many others. For a view of the growth patterns of this field, here's Professor Morton Schwartz of Long Beach, California State University.
The field is progressing rapidly. Medicine is progressing rapidly. But on a per-year basis, it's small. If one considers all that was known in medicine up to 1940, then in the last 30 years, it's doubled. Probably it'll double again in the next 20 years. Well, that's a lot of growth, a lot of revolution, a lot of expansion. In the early 60s, roughly about 10 years ago, there were several conferences, and everyone was very excited about the possibility of using electronic instrumentation to monitor patients. At that time, there were no instrumented with electronics, coronary care units, medical ICUs, surgical ICUs, pediatrics ICUs, burns ICUs, respiratory ICUs. At that time, there were none. Now, practically every hospital, even small ones, have coronary care or intensive care beds with electronic instrumentation. If we roll the clock back 10 years ago, everyone thought that was going to happen overnight. Of course, it didn't. It took 5 to 10 years to occur. The first companies that ventured into the field, most of them, went bankrupt or lost. That is, they evolved a product too quickly that didn't meet the needs and really was of little use. I think one problem has always been and probably will be is that engineering, physicists, and chemists, and mathematicians can provide technological overkill to the field of medicine. You can solve problems they have yet to define. And that has been a problem. I guess it continue to be a problem. With respect to the healthcare field, if we could lump all costs together in healthcare, if we roll the clock back to about 1950, you would find that about $12 billion a year was spent in healthcare. That has been rising dramatically so that today, at this minute, the annual rate is probably fairly close to $70 billion. In 1975, it can be projected to be close to $100 billion. And at about that time, become the largest industry in the United States, employing more people and consuming more products. To those of you who think of it as a potential area for a product line, healthcare field will be the number one industry. However, competition is very keen, and there are an awful lot of companies only get a small slice of the pie.
Please refer to Figure 1 in the pamphlet accompanying this cassette, where growth curves are shown for various aspects of the health industry.
Hospital daily service charges is the most rapidly rising curve. Actually, this curve is rising approximately 14% per year and has been doing so for the last 15 to 20 years. Hospital daily service charges alone by itself represents 38% of the $70 billion being spent today for medical services. All medical care and physicians' fee are rising in the same order of magnitude as the cost of living. But today, the average bed costs $100 a day in Southern California. By 1975, it'll be $200 a day. By 1980, it'll be $400 a day. There'll come a time in which you won't be able to afford acute care in the hospital. This is a very real problem. Something to worry about. One would like to think engineering talent could be used to design more effective hospitals or means of keeping patients out of the critical care areas into extended care areas or low-cost hospital environments where they won't need it to reduce the cost. The paperwork in today's hospital is normally $25 to $35 a day. If a system could eliminate all paperwork, of course it can't, but if it could, you have $33, roughly, to work against. A system might eliminate $10 to $15 worth of paperwork. And if it cost only, say, $8 a day, there could be a substantial savings. When you consider that in the United States per year, there are 50 million patient days or more, if you could save $10 a patient day, that's a substantial amount of money. only an order of about $100 million a year spent in cancer research, just to give an idea of the magnitude.
For the physician, the subdivisions of the health industry represent private practice, hospital services, diagnostic and screening centers for detection of disease, and, of course, medical research. By far the largest area of need and of current use of electronic and computer technology is in our hospitals. George Hickey is an engineer and consultant who works with a number of hospitals in helping them establish economical and effective instrumentation and other facilities using electronic equipment.
10 years ago, we began seeing the intrusion of electronics into the intensive care unit, or the creation of the intensive care unit because of the electronics, in which the electrocardiogram was monitored and displayed on an oscilloscope. Today, this display of electrocardiogram is still the general and wide-ranging means of monitoring. It is the presentation of raw data, primarily. And any intensive care unit has an electrocardioscope at the bedside. And within this past 10 years, the central station has evolved where this relatively raw data is again presented in the central area for several beds for the use of the nurse or doctor. However, in the last few years, other parameters have been brought in through transducers. We can observe direct blood pressure, arterial blood pressure, which is pulsatile in nature, periodic in nature, observe venous pressure, which generally is a DC signal, temperatures. Currently and in the near future, I would hope and expect that we will begin monitoring in the critical care areas respiratory parameters, monitoring work of respiration, gas exchange, things like this. Currently, this is a subject of R&D in industry. I would also look forward to the further development of a general field of critical monitoring known as fetal monitoring, where one is extremely interested in the state of the fetus within the womb. Currently, the electrocardiogram of the fetus is picked up and mixed naturally within the biological body, is mixed with the maternal electrocardiogram. This is separated, and a detection of abnormalities in the heart, electrical abnormalities, can take place. Tracking of the effort the fetus is going through during delivery, as it is synchronized with the contraction and so forth. These electrocardiograms primarily are picked up by surface electrodes early in the delivery phases, but later on, electrodes are placed directly on the fetus, on his scalp, if normal delivery, and direct fetal level electrocardiograms are then available for interpretation. On the horizon, however, is the use of pulse ultrasonic energy. Pulses of ultrasonic energy are passed in through the uterus, and any discontinuity in the biological tissue, of course, will cause an echo, and so you will be able to image various organs and the fetus itself. This does have current problems, such as there is no real measure of the amount of damage, if any, due to ultrasonic energy. People are currently working around 60 milliwatts per square centimeter, I understand, and there has been evidence of damaged chromosomes in this area. Of course, as pickups become more sensitive and so forth, we can decrease the amount of energy necessary for the ultrasonic generation. It's possible using ultrasonics for observing other organs, such as the heart. In most large hospitals, especially hospitals with open heart procedures available, you have what's known as a heart catheterization lab. This is strictly a diagnostic lab to evaluate directly the condition of the heart, presence of any shunts or malfunctions of valves. But I've seen pictorial evidence of the use of ultrasonics in observing the heart during its normal function, of observing three of the four valves, and this is all by non-invasive techniques. The heart catheterization lab must utilize invasive techniques. That is, if you run catheters, little tubes, right up the artery or vein into the heart, and pump in radio-opaque dyes, measure blood pressures and things like this. I would expect that in 5 years, virtually all patient monitoring will be just a step removed from the computer, and that step being a buffer amplifier. What does this do to hospitals? Well, it means a hospital probably will have to commit itself to dedicated computers for patient monitoring. You cannot depend on one central processing unit for what happens when it goes down or it has to be maintained. You cannot afford to have your monitoring system just simply shut off on you. So you must talk about multi-CPU computer systems that are probably dedicated to patient monitoring. This does suggest that in the future we will be going to a multiplicity of mini computers or microcomputers, perhaps one or two of which are managing the data bank or data file for patient monitoring. However, I don't feel that it's necessary that computers be a requirement for patient monitoring for all hospitals in the future. I mentioned a little earlier that primarily we're dealing with the raw data as it's presented in the intensive care unit. I suspect that through analog techniques and so forth that we may be able to present far more meaningful information for the medical professional without the use of computers, but with the use of more sophisticated system type of hybrid monitoring systems. That is, I think there probably will be a middle ground between today's raw data presentation and tomorrow's very large dedicated computer systems. Another issue with hospitals that is becoming very important is patient safety. And every time Ralph Nader seems to talk about it, comes a little more important for hospitals. And here's a role, that a place where engineers can play a very important role in the design of equipment and in the maintenance of safe conditions in hospitals. And I might say that the degree of electrical protection that you must supply a patient is astounding. You have to keep any source or sink, potential source or potential sink of current, to below 10 microamperes. And of course, with extremely complex instrumentation that is seen almost every day in hospitals, this instrumentation, these systems are just rich with ground loops, which each one being a generator of current. But we will be seeing in the near future and for the next several years a very deep running interest in electrical safety of patients until this becomes an established and well-defined field. That is, the instrumentation is just right for safety, the hospital engineer is up on electrical safety, and so forth. Finally, I'd like to get back to engineers, and I do feel that engineers will play an increasingly important role, especially from the standpoint of hospitals. And I would anticipate the day will come when every moderate and large hospital will have a qualified engineer who is primarily a double E, but probably a multi-disciplined man, knowing chemistry, biophysics perhaps, mechanics, things like this, that can only be useful in this intellectually rich field of biomedical instrumentation.
Acoustic techniques such as the fetal monitoring George referred to are probably best classed as research. For in medicine, to a greater degree than we engineers are accustomed to, research is mixed with everyday practice. As Dr. Schwartz indicated earlier, computerization in hospitals can be applied in many areas, not the least important of which is the data handling for the hotel-like business which every hospital carries on. There is, surprisingly enough, about 10 years of experience here. Some is good and some bad, as we will learn from Dr. B.G. Lamson, who is Director of Hospitals and Clinics for UCLA.
We have been at this business of attempting to bring improved methods of communication, including automation techniques that are computer-based, in the health industry now for about 10 years. At the beginning, the prospects appeared to be superb, and there were large sums of federal money and some very major commitments from private industry made in order to exploit this opportunity. It did appear at that time, and it still does appear, that in an ideal world, wherever we're dealing with sick people, whenever any information becomes available to those who will care for those people, it should be recorded in some form of database. It would accumulate over time in some organized fashion so that any pertinent part of it might be retrieved at will, and the entire record could be available anywhere in the world where that patient might subsequently have an illness. And of course, if you had all that information available, you would then be able to predict better than we can now the needs of the health service system and would manage the various facilities in order to achieve a high utilization, high efficiency, and a most economical service to our population at risk. Now, that's a rather impressive objective if you stop and think, and I'm now looking back 10 years and thinking of some of the reasons why those early efforts, you might say, were not entirely successful. I think one reason, or the principal reason, was, and still is, that the life experience of each one of us as a person encompasses an enormous range of variables, a great many of which bear upon the health, or potentially bear upon the health of that individual. And the database that is pertinent to our health ranges all the way from free-form prose, such as I'm using here, and highly quantified data characteristically recorded by numbers, such as input into a health system from clinical laboratories. A full spectrum of human communication. And in the early 60s, no really adequate means for handling any of the input problems in the medical arena. That has become painfully apparent now that this is the principal problem in developing improved communications in the health field. It is the data input problem. We should have known that in 1960 or 1961, but we were so excited about the prospects of plowing ahead that we concentrated on the nature of the communication flow, the interchanges that went on between physicians, paramedicals, and patients, and the institutions in which they worked, and tended to ignore the more mundane problems of inputting the needed information into the system. I think our attitude at that time, toward the medical profession particularly, and I must admit to be a member of that group, was that any group of professionals who were so archaic in their own methods of recording information, mainly the handwritten chronological record, that they must be very ignorant people, or at least people who are oblivious to the progress being made in other fields, so that all we have to do is come in and show them how to do it, and we'll get on with the thing. Now, I too am a bit perplexed as to why the medical profession found itself in this position in 1960, because by that time we had already had at least a 30-year experience in using punch card techniques for inputting data and for sorting it and retrieving it. Many of these elementary punch card techniques, which by then had already infiltrated widely into most business activities, most large industries, had had relatively zero impact upon medicine, except in those areas where hospitals were concerned with recording the in and outflow of dollars, where punch card-based accounting systems were moderately well developed. But the medical side of the problem was not developed at all, and in retrospect, it would have been possible in the 50s, in the 40s, and certainly in the 60s, to have developed quantified data systems that pertain to some of the easier problems in the medical arena, such as what patients are in the house, how many beds do you have available, the hotel problem in general, which is certainly one of the problems of managing a hospital. Now, why we did not do this, I do not know. If anything, it's an indictment of the marketing man among you. For here was obviously a fascinating market which was not exploited. But at any rate, in 1960, 61, when the push began to get into the modern era, there was very little to base the assault upon. There was very little in the way of well-defined files. Variables were very much free-form, unquantified, and we did not build upon decades of experience of handling information with unit record equipment such as occurred in the banking industry, insurance industries, and other areas concerned with large files. And it is possible that the absence of all of this did have some impact upon observers from other professions who, witnessing this major lack of development, assumed then that the problem was only because it had been neglected by the physicians and health administrators and could be readily solved if only the right people and the right techniques could be applied. Well, I'm not going to now try to go over the full 10 years of success and failure that has occurred. I think most of you are aware of the fact that major efforts to develop communication systems that would do everything that obviously needs to be done have practically, without exception, failed. Although they have provided useful information, and pieces of them are surviving today and being built upon as we more slowly approach the same goal. At the same time, there were other institutions that did not have major extramural resources and could not, fortunately in many cases for them, attempt an all-at-once solution, which elected to concentrate on the data collecting problems involved and have been pecking away at this issue over the last 10 years with some degree of success. I thought I might mention some of the things that stand out of my own mind as oft-repeated axioms that many of us have accepted as truths, which in retrospect may not have been helpful at all and may actually have been a hindrance. For example, I have often heard it said, do not automate the status quo. The status quo is based upon techniques of a prior era. Don't simply automate a cumbersome, ineffective system, but do it the right way. Do the job once and for all the right way now that you have superior equipment at hand. This is a disastrous principle if one leans upon it too much, because there is a temptation to ignore the quality of the personnel involved, the degree of logical thinking that permeates an institution, and the understanding of the people involved of what their problems really are. I mean by that, if you go into an area where there is utter chaos in a communication arena within a health service facility, your chances of automating anything that will be useful are very, very slim. You cannot automate chaos, and you should not try. But if you do not have some degree of well-developed methods at your disposal, if you are not satisfied that the people who must operate the communication systems understand what their needs are and are receptive to improve techniques, it is virtually impossible for outsiders to have sufficient understanding and sophistication to come in the midst of chaos and design a useful system that can be implemented and will stand on its own weight on a cost-effective basis once that's done. I know of no major application in the medical area where anybody has come into somebody else's shop with a pre-packaged automation scheme, imposed it upon a group of reluctant managers, inadequately trained personnel, even though they may be working in chaos at the time, with any degree of success. So we have found, looking back now over the 10-year period, that our greatest progress has been made where we can identify some degree of order and some degree of competence, some degree of willingness to understand the need to make things better. We don't necessarily automate exactly the status quo, but unless there is something to build upon, it is virtually impossible to automate anything. And if I could touch on that point with a comment to the marketing people among you, unless you are in a position to attempt to sell to every hospital simultaneously throughout the nation, I would certainly concentrate on those institutions that have some record for progress in this general area of communication, where you will find the strongest people and the most achievement. You will also often find the greatest opportunity to make further headway. Another fallacy: doctors are conservative and will resist change. They are going to have to change their ways in order to take advantage of new techniques. They are hopelessly behind the times. We will provide the techniques. It is up to them to change. Now, that type of thinking can lead you to disaster. In a perfect world, your world, that is, and not mine, it might be nice if all the doctors would change and learn to use all the input devices which you are prepared to design for them and sell them. But they are not going to do so unless it makes their job easier and unless it improves the efficiency of use of their time. Doctors are conservative, and if you think of what they spend their time doing, I hope you are glad that they are. They are the custodians of the health of people in many respects. They must bear the burden of many unsolvable problems where health cannot be improved or maintained. They are constantly seeking for ways to improve their capacity to do this, but they are not swayed by sales pitches and wild dreams of a better world unless they are convinced that, in fact, things will be better. Now, I have seen in the short period of my participation in this profession, physicians give up an entire lifespan of experience when suddenly new drugs become available on the market and old are thrown out. I went to medical school in the era when syphilis was treated primarily with arsenic compounds. Books were written on this field. They became obsolete almost overnight as penicillin became available. There are repeated episodes of this type of thing, so that to say that the physician is conservative and will not change is not in conformity with observed facts. He probably can throw away an old tool and adopt a new one more quickly than any group I know if he's satisfied and convinced that it will help. Now, one or two more comments. Remember that in this country, by and large, doctors do not work for hospitals. They do in the Veterans Administration, at least they work for a single organization. But in my own institution, which although owned by the Regents of the University of California, operates fully in the private sector, we buy and sell services in the open marketplace, and the doctors who practice medicine there have an independent one-to-one relationship with their patients. I believe as a physician that you, when you are ill, will treasure that type of relationship. Doctors, at least in this society, by and large, do not work for hospitals. Therefore, your hospital director, who will make the decision as to what to buy and what not to buy in his everlasting effort to control his resources, and spend the patient's money on those things that will help the patient the most, will be guided by that relationship. He cannot force the physicians to do something that will take more of their time or which they will not be happy with in order to achieve efficiency somewhere else. Finally now, just a glance ahead, some of the things that I feel we need very much and that you can help us with. We still need improved methods of data input. Much progress has been made, but this is an area that is wide open, in my view, for future development. And we need cheaper hard copy output from files that can be maintained in continuity without out-of-file conditions.
One of the fastest-growing areas in medical practice is periodic health screening, or multiphasic screening, as it is called. The aim here is to detect illness before it reaches the danger point. The ability to provide effective, low-cost screening is believed by many to be the key to better public health, especially for those people to whom a $100 physical examination fee represents an unacceptable cost. Dr. Morris Colon, who is Director of Medical Methods Research at Permanente Medical Group, Kaiser Foundation Research Institute, has views as to ways in which engineering techniques can be better applied in this area.
Whereas a couple years ago, there were only a half a dozen automated multiphasic health testing programs in this country, there is now, in 1971, a catalog which lists 104 such operational programs. When we speak of automated multiphasic screening, we don't mean just a panel of a dozen laboratory chemistry tests nor automated histories. Essentially, we mean a program which provides a battery of tests and physiological measurements of utility to the physician, and such incorporates the registration function and arranges for follow-up scheduling. Very essential, as we'll emphasize, every automated multi-test program to successfully perform needs to be within some community or medical care delivery system where the physicians will be able to properly utilize the data. Such a laboratory must include at least medical and some psychosocial history, some x-ray examination, some cardiovascular respiratory testing, eye, ear, nose, and throat examination, clinical laboratory tests, a reporting of the process, various tests involved to the physicians, and very important is some sort of a quality control monitoring. And the programs need to maintain a high quality. The physician wants accurately measured tests, complete values, not just that the patient has or has not an abnormality. Given a program with the functions described, such programs have multiple objectives. These programs originally started to provide disease detection, but this is now becoming a minor objective of the program, and mostly it is the monitoring through time of individuals who come back for their second, third, and fourth, and continual exams through time. And so it is necessary for a program to have a system whereby the base of information can be stored and compare each examination with prior examinations. This is a very high priority need that automated multi-test laboratories must all provide in order to survive in the future. The rest of these objectives, of course, are not necessarily related to electronics, but involve the capability of a program to satisfy both the providers of service and the receivers of service, and still do so within a reasonable cost, because many of the programs now being started provide their costs, begin to compare with the cost of providing periodic health examinations in a traditional manner. One should be able to provide an automated examination for one-third to one-fourth of the costs. And such involves a system approach in order to develop a system which can process large numbers of people, exploit the economy of scale, and provide tests at somewhere under $50 a piece, as compared to perhaps $100 a piece or $150 in the traditional manner. What are the needs to improve automated multi-test laboratories? And they involve both improvement of the system as a whole and improvement of a variety of subsystem components. I think it is fair to say that every station, every phase within current laboratories can stand and do need continual work to improve them as far as their accuracy, reliability, and cost is concerned. But the entire system needs to be examined and is being examined, both as to sequential flow of patients versus parallel flow of patients versus single stations where the patient sits in the chair and all the tests are brought to the patient. It is necessary to consider better patient and better specimen processing and improved integration of components, but the main problem is to develop some adaptive design, which is a problem we haven't solved and others haven't solved, in that patients who go through the laboratory all essentially have to go through the same tests. In other words, it is very difficult for current systems, current programs, to vary for age and sex and prior diseases. We would like to provide more information on people with certain conditions if they have those conditions, and those who are healthy not to necessarily go through a lot of other tests which are expensive. So an adaptive design for individual patient needs and service needs does require help from systems engineers to tailor it so through the same program, outpatients, inpatients, special examinations such as for employee examinations and so forth, all can go through the same program and adjust to them. And those for separating out people with certain conditions, establishing diagnosis, referring people in accordance with treatment necessary, all of these are, we need help in trying to develop a more adaptive design. Within such a program, for the healthy people, we do need improved health education and preventive maintenance clinics. Electronics engineers can help us with improved methods for decreasing errors due to improved patient identification and other quality control programs for both data control, test control, and so forth. Our objectives will then, given such equipment, develop better boundary limits. It must be emphasized that the accuracy of testing has much greater requirements for the healthy than for the sick. If a patient comes in whom you know has elevated blood pressure or elevated blood sugar, a difference of 5% is not serious. But when a patient is at the boundary between healthy and disease, a 5% may be the difference between expensive follow-up examinations, treatment, or none such. In addition to looking at the system, one has to look at each of the components. We've emphasized the great need for improved patient identification. We need machine-readable cards, such as credit cards. Currently, patients come in, and wherever they go, we must transcribe or key in patients' numbers and names and so forth. Considerable work is being done for a magnetic alphanumeric reading of such cards and codes in addition to optical readers. They are all very expensive. One needs a low-cost device to put at every registration desk, something under $1,000, where a patient can put in a card and it can read in the patient's number and then followed by other identifiers. And also methods whereby families can be linked, but especially the patient's own individual records. So as he goes between stations or between clinics, his record can all be brought together into a central database. We initially started by separating out every test into an individual station or phase. A basic systems approach is to break it down into small modules and work to develop the design and quality control for each small component and then tie them together. Once that has been done, then to improve efficiency and economy, you begin to rebuild and put together those subsystem components which can more efficiently work together. And so one of the things that we've been working towards and others is to bring back together, say, an individual cardiovascular test station, where at one station a patient can obtain evaluation of his heart sounds and electrocardiogram and cerebral circulation, peripheral circulation, and so forth. Going on to the methods of man-machine communication,
In the last few years, a considerable advance has appeared on the market by interactive terminals whereby patients can enter their histories directly into the computer. And this is something that a few years ago we wanted, and now we have. Now we need to have better low-cost terminals for the physicians so that in their individual offices they can interact with the database to get this history to them and get the rest of the tests back to them, so that every doctor, when a patient comes in, can key in and pull from the database the information he wants. I would say that's a very high priority item. One of the great needs is to truly define, truly operate as an automated multi-test laboratory. The majority of the programs now being installed are not automated health testing as the term has been defined. In other words, merely using automated equipment to measure blood pressure, or automated chemical analyzer to do test analyses, or automated data processing to regurgitate a report is not automated health testing or screening. Online, while the patient is there in real time, the computer looks at the tests and prints out essentially advice pre-programmed by the physicians as to which tests the doctor wants repeated before the patient sees the doctor. And if the patient falls in certain categories, to consider referring to certain special clinics and so forth. In order to do that, for example, the computer looks through all of the tests, and for example, if the patient has albumin in the urine, for example, the first thing the doctor is going to do is tell the patient to come in for a morning urine specimen and recheck it. So the computer prints out, before the patient leaves, a series of numbers transmitted by telephone, which the receptionist then tells the patient to carry out these instructions. That is online, real-time, automated testing. It is absolutely essential for such programs, when a patient comes back the second, third, fourth, fifth time, to be able to go back in the prior examinations and compare the tests of this examination to the prior ones. One needs to set up a continuing record so that within the record one has not only identification administrative information, but information on the examination of 1970, examination of 1971, and the various information of history, tests, and so forth, so that the computer can compare the cholesterol of this examination with the prior examination. The patient answered yes to a question this year, compared it last year to see whether this is a new symptom or an old symptom. And if the patient has had a moderately elevated test for the last several years, that's much less important than if this is an elevation this year, which was normal last year.
You have come to the end of side one of this issue of IEEE Soundings. To continue, simply stop the machine and turn the cassette to side two.